Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. We are online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. You can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to at kpcgfm and email us comments@kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk and Abraham Blondeau here today. How are you doing today, Abraham?
Doing pretty good.
Pet therapy. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I haven't.
This is something, this isn't for the pets, it's for the humans. The Science of Pet Therapy, it's written by Mandy Oaklander, says, being a pet in America is a pretty plum gig. Pets are incredibly well-loved. You could say the same in Canada, I suppose.
Yes, yeah.
People like their pets. According to a 2015 Harris poll, 95% of owners think of their animal as a member of the family. About half buy them birthday presents. Interesting. And it's a two-way street, they said. People who have pets tend to have lower blood pressure, heart rate, and heart disease risk than those who don't. Those health boons may come from the extra exercise that playing and walking require and the stress relief of having a steady best friend on hand. So they're digging into this a little bit to see the health benefits of people having and caring for pets kindly. And they're finding that it does the body good.
Yeah, I've heard other scientific studies over the years along a similar vein saying every time you pet a cat, it relieves your stress or any other pet, I guess. And all these different things, how animals, if you treat the animal right and if it's a nice companion, mm-hmm. that it does more for you, makes you more of a selfless individual, different benefits like that. It's harder to find other ways than just having a pet.
They have some examples here of what some common pets do, the benefits. In one study, a stressed-out group of adults were told to pet a rabbit, a turtle, or their toy forms. So, in other words, either a real one or a toy. I don't know that I'd ever pet a turtle, but that's an interesting thought. They say the toys had no effect. You'd probably feel a little more awkward as an adult petting a toy. But stroking a living creature, whether hard-shelled or furry, relieved anxiety. And I guess that's what they were trying to determine with the rabbit and the turtle. Does it matter if it has fur or if it's hard-shelled? It worked for people regardless of whether they initially said they liked animals. So it helped all of them calm down a little bit, which is pretty interesting. I guess people have pet turtles. I would think you would just look at them. I don't think I would pet them, but maybe some people do.
Yeah, I think I've seen people pet turtles like on their head, not on the shell part, but just personally, I think turtles they're cool to look at, but I don't really want to touch them that much because they do carry things. You always have to wash your hands and it's just a hassle.
The fish say animals can focus people's attention. When people at an Alzheimer's disease facility dined in front of aquariums with brightly colored fish, they ate more, got better nutrition, and were less prone to pacing. They were also more attentive and less lethargic, which is interesting. I always like fish in aquariums. I think they're fascinating, and I don't know. They're very soothing to watch them kind of float around in there. So apparently it's helping people with Alzheimer's as well.
Yeah. I think there's just being around natural environment and seeing animals and that sort of thing, I think does help humans think more and maybe engage your brain a bit more than just looking at opaque walls and contemporary paintings.
Right.
But I guess the only exception to that rule is the shark tanks and Dr. No, the James Bond movie. I'm pretty sure that would probably cause more anxiety than stress relief.
Yes. If the animal's going to attack you, that would change things. Crickets. Animals don't have to be cuddly to help. In a 2016 study published in the Journal of Gerontology, elderly people who were given 5 crickets in a cage became less depressed after 8 weeks than a control group. The act of caring for a living creature seemed to make the difference. Crickets, of all things. Now, I will say, if I'm trying to sleep and I can hear crickets or frogs, that's a much better deal for me. I grew up hearing them because we had pond nearby. And, you know, the only people who even buy like recordings of that, because it does help you sleep. It just is a nice sound. Cicadas, not the same effect for me. crickets, frogs. It helps me sleep for sure.
Yeah. Well, I think most people like when the rain's falling on the roof and that sort of thing helps us fall asleep. Kind of related, but not really. I did see one of my friends tweeted a story where in Seattle, they're serving grasshoppers, like a bowl of roasted grasshoppers with seasonings and stuff at baseball games. And it's so popular, they're usually bought out. So that's the new trend, I guess, in Seattle.
They help you sleep and then you eat them.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Well, they're always doing something different. Dogs, of course, I think this one would be obvious, but this is an interesting note. Some research suggests that when children who struggle with reading read aloud to a trained dog and handler, they show fewer anxiety symptoms. Their attitudes change and their skills improve. Which is interesting in and of itself, because how much of, say, our inability to really improve in certain areas is anxiety-based? Like, we worry about it so much that we can't relax and just do it. That probably is true of a lot of things, and so these dogs are helping the kids relax, and when they relax, then they do better.
Yeah, well, I think, especially with younger people in a educational environment, a big hindrance is... not necessarily the vanity, but when you don't want to be embarrassed, if you're not good at something, you don't want to read in class, you don't want to do these different things, because it's embarrassing if you're not good at something. And so I think that can hold a lot of people back from focusing on that or trying to improve on it. But that, I think that's a great idea where you don't have any pressure. The dog's not going to judge you for anything. And so, but you still get the practice in, and that pressure and that embarrassment is gone.
It's really fascinating to think about that, because anxiety is pretty much a vanity-based issue, right?
Yeah.
Because, yeah, like you say, if you had to sing a song out loud, even if you're a really untrained singer and you're embarrassed by it, and it was to a group of chickens, you don't care, right? I don't think anyone would be worried about the chickens. But if it's a person that might think something of you or think less of you, then it becomes a problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, how many people sing in the shower? And they belt it out and they don't care, because most people can't hear them. I'm sure some neighbors can. But on the whole, though, I think most of our anxiety, what we worry about, kind of how we dress, how we carry ourselves, this is the things we stress out about. We're worried about how people perceive us, if it will damage our reputation, if we don't fit in with a certain norm or that kind of thing. I think if those are removed, the actual problems that would stress us out are actually very small, but it's actually just our perception is what causes us to be, and it's based on vanity. We want to be perceived a certain way, and so we stress out about when something challenges that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Horses are really valuable in helping people. It says, among the most studied therapy animals, horses have been involved in medical treatment plans in Europe since the 1860s. Activities like grooming a horse and leading one around a pen have been shown to reduce PTSD symptoms and in children and adolescents. I've seen that actually, because I happened at some one point live near somebody that had a child with some of those. I don't know what the difficulty was, but something. And when they got on a horse, because they would get they got a pet horse, the child relaxed totally.
Yeah,
for whatever reason. So I don't know that they know why exactly. I think that's what they're still looking at, but they know that the results are good.
Yeah, I think some animals, just the way they are, they have a natural connection with people. They connect better, or it seems like they're almost made for human interaction, for our use, like domesticated cats, animals, or cats and dogs, and then horses. I mean, it's been proven even on battlefields that horses were very noble companions. They actually helped a lot of soldiers through different things. And same thing with the canine units in Vietnam and other places. The dogs helped the soldiers a lot through difficult times. So it is interesting just how certain animals just have a greater capacity for companionship than others.
And finally, one of the animals they're studying is guinea pigs. Animals make socializing easier for kids who find it stressful, according to Maggie O'Hara of Purdue. In her study, when children with autism had a guinea pig in the classroom, they were more social with their peers, smiled and laughed more, and showed fewer signs of stress. It's kind of a classic grade school classroom animal. I think we had several over the years. I think they were guinea pigs or gerbils or different things. I thought it was just for fun, but maybe they were trying to get us to relax and smile more.
Yeah, well, I think especially young kids, they love little creatures, and it's a topic of conversation and that sort of thing. But I think too, when you have an animal, you have to care for it. You have to make a choice whether you're going to be responsible, feed it on time, make it feel comfortable, give it what it needs, because it's completely relying on you for everything in those circumstances. And so I think having animals helps, especially young people, learn responsibility and selflessness in a way where if you don't care for the animal, bad things are going to happen and it's your fault. And I think especially with animals, if you mistreat an animal, it's, especially in society, it's deemed as an evil thing. It's a lot of strict laws about that. And so I think, and there's good reason for that, because we're supposed to take care of animals, and it helps, it reflects on our character, helps build good things in us.
So interesting study there about pet therapy and how those animals can help people in a lot of different ways. I was taking a walk through the park a couple days ago, and we happened to come upon this area where there were, I think it was red-winged blackbirds, which I was like the way they, the song they sing. And it was near a pond. There were frogs and things. It was very relaxing. I was walking with my family, and I mentioned it. I was like, this is really nice, because it sounded like home. It sounded like where I grew up. In the spring, you'd always hear those sounds. And definitely, I don't know that I was stressed, but it definitely made me feel good in general. So the sounds, just the presence of different animals like that, it can really soothe people.
Yeah, it's amazing how I think nature's probably the best way to relax people. And it's just things that are naturally there rather than maybe some other more sophisticated man-made ways of finding relaxation. A lot of the times it's just nature does the trick. And I did see a funny thing on Twitter my wife showed me. And I think it might have been... I was studying some kind of study like that. It says petting a dog helps you relieve stress. And it said if you invest in the stock market, it's always better to pet a dog and watch all your, or you're always less stressed petting a dog and watching all your money get washed down the drain from the stock market, something like that. And it's true, just that usually we put ourselves in tough situations that we don't necessarily need to, and animals bail us out sometimes.
Then look for relief from the situation we caused. Here's an interesting note. Sanctuary state bill passes in California. California is set to become a sanctuary state after its Senate passed a bill to prohibit state and local law enforcement agencies from using their resources to help the federal immigration enforcement. State Senator Kevin DeLeon, the bill's author, said it was about making communities safer, not less safe. Not sure how he figures that exactly, but you see this conflict between the federal government and state governments when it comes to enforcing immigration policies.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting, because I think every generation there's always a battle of state rights versus the federal government, and it manifests itself in different ways. A long time it was racial rights, minority rights, which is still a case maybe some people might make, but I think the big one now is immigration. Can the federal government impose regulations that are passed by a democratic body? President Obama essentially ruled by decree on immigration policy that a lot of these states like California approved of. When the opposite's true, they rebel against regulations passed by a democratic body of legislation like Congress, where the people that America elected made the bill, and then they say it's for whatever reason it's not good enough. And so I think it's be interesting to see where they stand. And I think as I think the fruit's already there, that it's going to cause a lot more problems than solve anything, because we've already seen violence in San Francisco and other places where I think the California economy is going to suffer because they're not making California safer.
Yeah, and that's the puzzling part about that, making communities safer, not less safe. Anytime you don't enact the laws that are on the books, it's going to lead to bad things. unless it's a really, really horrible law, like some sort of dictatorial, you know, law, but this isn't like that. Related to that, they say here that Attorney General Jeff Sessions hinted that he may pull back on consent decrees, that's police reform agreements enforced by the courts and pursued by President Obama. And so they want to take away some of those restraints from the police. And here's how three cities are responding to that. Baltimore, top city officials say they oppose federal efforts to delay police reform and vow to move forward after already agreeing to revise officer trainings. On April 5th, a federal judge denied a request from the Justice Department for a delay to reconsider the reforms. So these cities that are pretty violent, they want police reform, but they're the most violent cities. And so it's just interesting because I don't think it makes them safer. I think it's getting worse, and the numbers say that it is.
Yeah, I think police reform, I'm sure it's needed in a lot of places, and it's always good to take a fresh look at any institution and see what improvements can be made. But at the same time, you do have to be careful with how you manipulate things and what you change. And you always have to be ready to change if it's not working. That's just part of, I think, America, how it's worked over the years. And with police reform, if it's allowing violence and not stopping it, then obviously there's a big problem there. And especially with the police reform, I think it should be, there should be more of a consensus and more of a discussion on what should be reformed rather than have it done on such a local level, because then I think it just will cause more and more issues.
Right, because they've, in some of these cities like Baltimore, they've tried some reform, I guess, and things have gotten worse as far as I can tell. So it's kind of, the idea is sort of, I guess, is that, well, there's still problems, so we need more reform. Well, maybe you need to go back. Maybe you need to go the other direction with it instead of going further. Ferguson, Missouri, which, of course, has kind of been a real hotbed for this, the city has already agreed to make over 300 law enforcement reforms, including the formation of a civilian review board. It doesn't sound like a good idea. Because who are the civilians reviewing it if they're the criminals? I'm not saying they are, but they could be. Then, of course, they're not going to like what the police do. Officials say they're making progress, but activists have expressed frustration. The activists want more radical change.
Yeah, it's, I think if we look at how the police have their job have changed over the last few years, the changes or the increase in violence isn't a reflection on police officers doing a bad job. It's more of a reflection on the pressure, the undue pressure being put on them to not make certain arrests or to, they have to view their job in a political light, and that's changing how they do their job. The reform, I'm sure the reforms can be made, but I think the big problem is media pressure and political pressure. It's not the police. The police institutions don't need as much of a change as the whole public perspective on it.
Chicago, finally, what are they doing? After city police were found to have engaged in a, quote, pattern or practice of unconstitutional force, I'm not really even sure who discovered or like who said that was the case, but some have. Officials agreed to make substantial changes. Officials say they are committed to reform regardless of the Trump administration's next move. Chicago, huh? Interesting. April, this month, to date, there have been 25 shot and killed in Chicago, 169 shot and wounded, 194 total shootings, 27 homicides. This week, which has only been a few days, there's been 3 killed, 26 shot and wounded, 29 shot in total, and 3 homicides. A person is shot in Chicago every 2 hours and 46 minutes. So something needs to change, but I don't know that it's I don't know that this is going the right direction. Some of these reforms that started really in the Obama administration.
Yeah, well, I think we all need to ask ourselves, when there's that scale of violence, should we empower the police more to intervene, or should we take away their empowerment to stop those types of things? I mean, those numbers, they're very similar to what was going on in Iraq in 2006 before the troop surge. In some cities in Iraq, there were 2 to 3 murders a day. And you had a Marine station there all the time. So, I mean, it took professionally trained troops to stop that kind of violence. And now situations are completely different, but that should give you an idea of how intolerable that situation should be for Americans, where one of our biggest cities, our most famous cities, in certain parts of it have the same crime level as a war zone. And so I think that should be a cause for concern. There does need to be reform. It reminds me of the most famous police reformer probably in American history is Theodore Roosevelt. Before he became president, he became a police chief in New York City. And New York City was infamous for corruption. The police chief and the gangs and that kind of thing were all connected to make profits off of smuggling and different things like that. And what Roosevelt did is he didn't call a press conference to make a big deal. What he did, he disguised himself every night and walked the beats with the cops until 3 a.m. most nights, just him by himself. And if he saw a police officer doing something wrong, he would confront them and order them to go back to work. And in a matter of years, he transformed New York from the most corrupt to the most proficient police force. And then they kicked him out because they were tired of him stopping corruption. But it takes personal leadership and courage and change at the level where you need good leadership examples, not activism and political pressure like that. I think that's the key to reforming any problems like that.
That's a really good point. A couple more numbers here from Chicago. I mean, you know, people may not like them, but these are the numbers. Year to date, 161 shot and killed, 768 shot and wounded, 929 total shot, 171 homicides. As mentioned, a person is shot every 2 hours and 46 minutes. A person is murdered in Chicago every 15 hours and 1 minute. So you guaranteed several a day, probably. Where did they break these numbers down? Where do people get shot? The most of them are shot in the head. 54 have been, in 2017, have been killed when they were shot in the head. 32 in the chest, 11 in the back, 8 in the face, 7 in the abdomen, 6 in the neck, 6 in the side, 1 in the leg. So people are out trying to kill other people. The race of victim and assailant, it's 14.4% Hispanic, 3.9% white or other, 79.6% black. Those are the numbers. And the cause of deaths, there 94% of them are gunshots, 3% are stabbings, 2.4% are others. That's Chicago. So, you know, whenever they talk about police reforms and wanting to get more radical in really making the police sort of criminals more than the criminals, actually. You got to look at those numbers. They're pretty horrifying. Like you said, it's a war zone.
Yeah. Well, I think in most circumstances, if it wasn't for, I think the political climate is today, there already would have been radical action by any other administration or mayor. A state of emergency would have been called or something like that to stop the murders and get some semblance of order and then start looking at what we can reform. It's always better to restore order first and then let's look at what we can do later because it's hard to reform things in the midst of chaos and murders. And so as indicated by those numbers, I think it's not just the police that need to be reformed. There's a lot of societal issues that need to be fixed, a lot of generational problems that need to be reformed too. And so I think it's just putting a Band-Aid on a problem if we're just pointing the finger at the police when there's a lot bigger issues at stake here.
Yeah, some huge issues, some terrible numbers. You're listening to Trapper Radio Live. We are on 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm, and the live link at thetrumpet.com. You can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm and email us comments at kpcg.fm. Abraham, let's take a look at your history note today. You have a history poll that you put up on Twitter at Abraham Blondo, and you can tell us maybe the what the poll question was and what the results are.
Sure. Yeah. So I put this up at the end of last week, and because there are lots of news articles coming out about British colonialism in India, and there were with Neil Ferguson, other prominent historians, they were finger pointing and getting into a bit of a discussion about whether it was sadistic or not, or whether there are any benefits to British colonialism at all. Lots of debate over the raw numbers of India's economic development. And so I just thought I'd ask this general public what they thought about it. So the question was, what do you think of British colonialism in India? And I gave them four different options. And I also had lots of discussion. I had about close to 20 responses to this over Twitter. So lots of people got engaged with this. The four options, one was beneficent, two, good but mistake-ridden, three, completely misguided, and four, evil and shameful. Those are the four options. And it was pretty even voting. I think all four had over 10% at least. And out of 101 votes, 37% thought beneficent was the correct view or what they thought about it. 29% thought it was good but mistake-ridden. 16% thought it was completely misguided. And 18% thought it was evil and shameful. So it's pretty split opinions out there, I think.
Did it? Were you able to see where the votes came from in terms of those that thought it was good versus those that thought it was terrible? Like, was it regional more where those ideas came from, or was it just kind of probably more personal?
I think some of it was personal, from what, because I can't see who votes for it. It's,
okay.
It's a, but based on what people were responding about it, I found that most British historians and people from the UK who did vote on it, there were some people from India who did vote on it, they mostly were in the negative column. Some were very strong in their comments on Twitter, condemning the British Empire, calling it evil and shameful. I think the more positive responders were from America, that said it was beneficent and good but mistake-ridden. Not all the time, but I think from what I can tell anyway, that's how the people voted. So I think you can see some of it's just a reflection in what people know about certain subjects. But from the comments, it almost ascended into a full-blown argument between a few different individuals about whether the British Empire had any benefit, whether colonialism in general is evil, if it's misguided, and that sort of thing. So it was a great discussion. I think it's the most I've ever had from one of these history polls. But you can see it's still a pretty divisive issue.
In the discussion, did people have good, valid points, or was it just more of an emotional sort of, it was bad and not supported, or it was good and not supported, or did they know some history about it?
I think a couple of people had pretty emotional responses, which they might have a good reason for. But overall, I think it was a pretty, both sides brought up valid points. And that's that in India, people who thought it was evil and shameful or completely misguided is that the British did impose a certain system in which they were beneficiaries of, and not all the time, but a lot of people who ran that system were racist, or they did. It's common knowledge that they did gouge the economy there, and that's just the way it went. Not everyone, but there were some people like that, and so. I think there are some valid points on of dissatisfaction with the Indian people, because they weren't given the same chances like the American colonies were. They weren't given state assemblies. They weren't given certain voting rights. They weren't given all these things that America was. And so their colonial experiences are much different. At the same time, on the other side, I think it's beyond reproof that there is data that shows there were a lot of benefits that came to India from Britain. And I think Britain did it, probably they could have done it much better in many circumstances, but they did bring with them benefits that India still has today. That is a lot of good educational institutions, military institutions, and also just being able to trade with a worldwide empire. It was a British merchant marine that brought Indian goods around the world, And without that, they probably would have been exploited by the Dutch, the Belgians, the Germans, the Russians, who wouldn't have treated them any better than the British. It would have been much worse.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's easy enough to look at a period of history, like, say, the colonialism, and say, well, if Britain wasn't there, it's easy to assume that they would have just gone on their own and things would have been fine. But maybe some other power takes over, or, you know, maybe they have a horrible time. It's always hard to know what would have happened if there, something else occurred. Like, we always assume, I suppose, it would have been better, but there's not always the case. It may have been far worse. So that's always hard to know, because there's just no way to know.
Yeah, it's always hard with hypotheticals because you can't be dogmatic. I mean, no one knows because it didn't happen. But I think if you do look at just a general broad sweep, comparing what other empires did to their peoples to what Britain did, even that Britain's worse. They made I think they committed some terrible crimes in certain places in the world. It's because people, they just had the wrong leaders there. But at the same time, you compare that to what Japan did to the Chinese or any other people they conquered, what the Germans did, what the Russians did to their own people, never mind if they controlled someone else, even what the French and Belgians did inside their colonies. It's based on other colonial experiences, it's pretty safe to say that the Indians would have been exploited much worse than what Britain did. And I think without British presence there in India, other Far Eastern empires would have attacked India far earlier than World War II. And so, I mean, like I said, you can't be dogmatic about it, but I think based off of what we know about history, most other empires were far more brutal and just oppressive compared to what Britain was in India.
That would be another good poll question. What was the, you know, rank it best to worst colonial experience?
That would be.
Because yeah. That puts things in a different perspective then. I mean, anybody can look at their situation and find something that they don't care for. But sometimes it's a lot better than maybe another situation too. The grass is always greener, like they say, but not always. Not realistically, it's not always that way.
Yeah, well, I think something, one of the big points of debate at this moment is some new books came out condemning Winston Churchill about the Bengal famine in 1943, where I think about 4 million Indian people died, and some people criticize him from stopping grain shipments from going to India and going to Europe instead and that sort of thing. I don't know enough about it to make any kind of statement about it at this time, but if we do look at other events, the leaders of certain Indian freedom parties who wanted the British out, they wanted the Japanese to come in. They'd rather have the Japanese than the British in India. And they were actually plotting this until Churchill threw them in jail. But based off of the rape of Nanking and other experiences where British soldiers surrendered to the Japanese, it would have been a terrible mistake if that happened, if the British left in 1941. Because India would probably still be recovering from Japanese invasion. And so when we look at history, there's always two sides to the coin. And I think it's just good to look back and realize that Britain made a lot of mistakes, but they did defend India from a terrible scourge of Japan. And I think they do deserve a little bit of credit for that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Interesting to look at some of that history. And it's funny how there's sort of an established narrative of history, and then there's always a new book that comes out.
Yeah.
Somebody tries to look at it differently, and sometimes there's value to that, sometimes there's not. And that's pretty interesting. You have one other story for us today. We'll end on an exciting one. Who's not excited about sea monsters? Giant sea scorpions were the original sea monsters, say University of Alberta researchers. That sounds horrifying.
Yeah. They have a artist rendering of it, and it's not something I would ever want to see, even in a real picture at any point in my life. What these people did at the University of Alberta is they put together a bunch of fossils they found over time, and this they're saying this was 430 million years ago. So basically it was around the time the dinosaurs in those different periods where you didn't have humans around. And they found these fossils that suggest that there are these huge scorpions. They're about 10 feet long. And they would in the their water, so they were in the sea. They had thin, flexible bodies. And they had two terrible things about them. Some of them had pincers, like normal scorpions had. Then they also had a long, serrated tail they could slash things with. So imagine a 10-foot-long scorpion. I mean, that's terrible enough as it is. But swimming pretty fast through the water, had huge pincers and a razor-sharp tail. And these things would just prowl the oceans, just looking for anything it could devour.
We would not fare well against that creature. That's a terrifying, terrifying thought. It is amazing when you look at the dinosaurs. I mean, from what we know about them and the skeletons, these huge animals, and then of course you think of the sea creatures, which I think, I don't know, for some reason seem even more terrifying. Maybe it's because of the unknown of water.
Yeah,
you can't see what's going on there. Man would not have done well in those instances. I know there are people out there that think there were, you know, cavemen running around and stuff, but even a little logic tells you you wouldn't have made it.
Yeah, well, just watch Jurassic Park, and you know that, because that's based on science,
right? Yeah,
but the humans, there's no way we can survive in that environment. I mean, we would have been the lowest thing on the food chain. We would have been gone first, because there's no way our bodies can fight against creatures like that. And like you mentioned with the sea creatures, it's because back then the scale of everything was so much bigger. Sea creatures were huge. I mean, and they had the huge, huge fangs and teeth that just would even kill the biggest land predators. Like the biggest land predators look nothing compared to those huge sea creatures. Mm. And I think probably for us the most terrifying thing was the insects. Back then, how big they were compared to now, like mosquitoes were the size of birds and that sort of thing. That would just be terrifying.
Yes, it would.
So, I mean, just the scale is so much bigger back then, and we couldn't survive in that. And thankfully, all these things died out before humans were around because, just even the memory of them would be terrifying.
So the University of Alberta there, did they find the fossils up in that region? This is Canada we're talking now, right?
Yeah.
Did they find those up there, or did they just collect them from around the world?
It doesn't say where they found them. They're in Alberta, especially in the north, the Badlands area. There's lots of, it's one of the hot spots for fossils.
Hmm.
So I assume they got some from there. But they didn't find the actual like scorpion fossil, but they, based off of partial fossils and other things they found, it seems like it's probably the only creature that it could be based on what they could find. And so there's more of it in the, comes out in the American Naturalist March 2017 edition. They have the full report in there if people want to read the full thing. But yeah, it's, based off of fossils and what we know about other creatures similar at that time period. They were big, they were deadly. And, it's amazing. We still have a few little impressions of them left
yeah.
after thousands of years, if not more.
Yeah, it's, you know, even like a scorpion, the benefit we have is we're much bigger than they are.
Yeah.
So if you got a shoe on, you can probably step on the thing. But any little guy like that, if you look at him closely, you think, wow, that thing was bigger.
Yeah.
We'd have some real problems. It's horrifying. It's just that they're small, thankfully, in comparison to us. There was a story today on the news. A family woke up. I don't know where it was. I didn't see all the details. They had a 10-foot alligator in their house. It got up. It crawled up onto the second-story deck and crawled in through they had an open window or something. And I didn't know they could get up like that.
Yeah.
Imagine waking up and seeing that. That's been in the news a few times. It does happen. But, you know, the idea of something in your home you're not expecting is horrifying. But especially something like that, I assume they are okay, but that'll give you the fright of your life for sure.
Yeah, well, actually a couple months ago, I woke up, walked into the bathroom. I take a shower every morning, open the shower curtain, and there's this huge spider sitting in the bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
And so
taking a bath?
I put him in a watery grave. But yeah, I just, I mean, and he was pretty fair sized, but I mean, it's not a big deal. He's, there's many ways I could have disposed of him.
Yeah.
But with those bigger creatures, I mean, that's really dangerous. And I did see, I almost wanted to talk about this story, but it was too disgusting. But they found these huge, they're called, ship worms. And they're probably about 3 feet long. They're worms about 3 feet long. They look disgusting. But they found them in the Philippines, and they live in bogs, uh-huh. The place where there's decomposing matter.
Yeah.
And they burrow in the ground. And they make this, like, this hard tube around them, and they just eat off of bacteria and decomposing matter. But yeah, they're like 3 feet long, and they're just disgusting to look at. But they help break down decaying matter. But we just discover them. And when you walk through the Philippines, you might see little tubes coming on the ground. There are plants, but they're not. They're these huge worms.
Oh, really?
Just living under the ground.
Have you seen that?
Not when I was there. No, okay. I was never in an area like that. But people walk through those areas, and they didn't. Maybe they just assumed what they were, but they look like a little plant or like dead tree sticking up, but they're actually these tubes from these worms.
Wow. How strange. Nature's garbage, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really, really interesting. That's an interesting write-up there about the original sea monsters, they think. But it makes you think, well, because you can think about the scale of things today. Scorpions are not that big compared to some other things. So if the scale was the same and the scorpion was 10 feet, how big is the the spider or the snake or whatever? Yeah, it's really fascinating. So animal stories are always interesting and sometimes horrifying. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us. Make sure this is for the Key of David program and the Trumpet Daily Radio Show coming your way here in a bit. For myself, Dwight Falk, Abraham Blondo, have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.